Whether you're wanting a new in-ground pool installation or have your old pool transformed in your backyard, Pooltech MI is a company to help your home get a new innovative look. Custom design your pool to bring individuality and beauty to your backyard. New construction is professionally managed from concept to completion, bringing your vision to life. Serving primarily in the Southwest Michigan area, Pooltech MI specializes in in-ground swimming pool installations. You can contact Pooltech MI for any pool-related assistance by calling 269-487-8550 or emailing pooltechmi@gmail.com between the hours of 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Monday to Fridays, and from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturdays. They are closed on Sundays. That's 269-487-8550 or email pooltechmi@gmail.com.
They think we're lazy.
They think we're weak-willed.
They think we're entitled.
They think we're selfish.
They think we don't care about anybody but ourselves.
We are compassionate.
We are resourceful.
We are capable.
We want to make a difference in the world.
We are underestimated.
Welcome to the third episode of our six-part series for the case of Jeanette Robertson. Thank you for taking the time to listen about Jeanette's case and helping spread awareness about her case. During our investigation, we spoke to a variety of people. When we traveled to the walk for Jeanette in Reed City, we got to speak to Brenda and many others who knew Jeanette. The unwavering support for Jeanette, despite the cold weather, illustrates the strength of community and determination in the face of adversity. This commitment is visible in the actions of her supporters who walked along the path Jeanette had taken. One woman, even while feeling unwell, chose to continue the walk, demonstrating the lengths to which people will go for someone they care about. Towards the end of the walk, we got to speak to the head detective on Jeanette's case, Aaron Tupfergen, from the Michigan State Police. Me, Chelsea, and Stephanie got to be the ones to interview him. I can't answer the questions we asked. We would spoil the theory we have. It was difficult to get many answers out of him since he legally couldn't give us information.
These are really good questions. That's a really good question. And you'll see me struggle with that because I'm limited as to what information I can share specifically about case details. We talk all the time about things like knowledge only the offender would know. And you always try to corroborate. Hopefully someday this case ends with a confession. And we will always try to legitimize that confession with knowledge only the offender would have. We also don't reveal what evidence we have because that would either make a suspect comfortable or uncomfortable.
However, one of the first people we spoke to at the start of the case was Jenny Decker, the author of the book Redacted, A Search for Truth About the Murder of Jeanette Robertson, released on March 15, 2015. The book Redacted is about Jenny's mission on finding the truth about what happened the day of Jeanette's murder and why justice has not yet been served. We aim not only to uncover the details surrounding Jeanette's disappearance and death, but also to preserve her memory and share her story. When we spoke to Jenny, we learned her investigation was hampered by a lack of readily available information and witnesses. The main obstacle was that Jeanette's case was still deemed an open case, meaning that the detectives were not required to share the case files with Jenny. Therefore, since Jeanette's case was still active, the detectives had the legal right to withhold vital information from Jenny.
Despite the challenges, Jenny's persistence eventually paid off as she managed to obtain the case file. However, this success came with its own set of complications. The files she received were heavily redacted, meaning that crucial details had been obscured or removed entirely.
The way this crime scene was handled was a problem. Law enforcement, how they, I had to go to city council to get the records released just from the city cops. And they were highly redacted too. I had to fight with them to get them. I had to stand in front of them and plead my case.
This posed a significant challenge for Jenny, as the lack of information made it difficult to understand the specifics of the incident, especially regarding the layout of the pet store and the basement where significant events took place.
Understanding the scene of a crime is crucial in any investigation. It helps to reconstruct the events leading up to the crime and ascertain crucial evidence that could help solve the case. When Jenny shared the case file with us, the heavily redacted information, it left us with more questions than answers. We could not visualize the crucial areas involved, which ultimately hindered our ability to be effective. We tried to get access to Jeanette's full case files by filling out Freedom of Information Act requests to the Michigan State Police in hopes of receiving the full case files. It is crucial to understand the timeline of events and any potential leads overlooked in the initial investigation. FOIA requests play a vital role in ensuring transparency and accountability within law enforcement. The success of our FOIA request was shown when we received a full 166-page case file for Jeanette's case that no one has ever seen before. With this case file, we have just opened doors for information. The memory of Jeanette and the efforts to uncover the truth surrounding her case will hopefully serve as a catalyst for improved investigation techniques and greater community awareness surrounding missing persons. Even though we wanted an answer to what happened to Jeanette, we also wanted to spread more awareness about who Jeanette was. It was difficult to find people who personally knew Jeanette. However, we managed to find Lana, Jeanette's sister. In speaking with Lana, we learned quite a bit about Jeanette. The sweet and gentle person she was.
You know, you see those people that put happy faces on?
Yeah.
And do a lot of things for people.
Mm-hmm.
But their lives aren't really that well. She was like that.
After speaking with Lana, we received the autopsy from her. Before we tell you about the autopsy, we want to give you a trigger warning. Everything we will discuss in the autopsy is graphic and can be hard to stomach. In the autopsy, the cause of death is craniocerebral trauma. Craniocerebral trauma is a traumatic injury involving the cranium and the incranial structures, such as the brain, cranial nerves, meaning, and other structures. In Jeanette's case, she has a linear laceration of the forehead with an underlying depressed skull fracture and brain restorations and contusions, meaning she had straightforward cuts, usually caused by sharp objects like knives or a glass on her forehead. With depressed frontal skull fracture, a break in the cranial bone or crushed portion of skull, with depression of the bone in towards the brain and bruises of the brain, usually caused by a direct, strong blow to the head. Brain lacerations are tears in the brain tissue caused by a foreign object or pushed in bone fragments from a skull fracture. This trauma was caused by a circular object with paint on it. We know this because in the autopsy, paint fragments were found on the frontal bone.
Other objects were found where she had multiple paired stab wounds made by instruments such as a fork and multiple cut wounds of the neck. There was localized served blunt force injury to the chest and abdomen, such as ones that might be made by stomping. In the autopsy, we also learned that most of the weapons were found at the scene of the crime. In the autopsy, it is said that at least three types of weapons, in addition to hand or feet, were used to torture the victim, who was believed to have been alive, although unconscious until receiving the crushing blow to the forehead, which is believed to occur last.
So there were clear indications that this did not happen quickly. I have been back there with her for some time. The fatal injuries were at the end. And what I can tell you is that her face area, skull, was beaten beyond recognition. There was blood spatter on the back of her hands. I'm sure you can guess what that would tell you. There was a sexual component to the crime. She was first reported in the paper as it being her being partially clad. And I can tell you that her jeans and undergarments had been pulled down. There were multiple weapons and multiple wounds in this case.
Besides these injuries, Jeanette was also violated with a rod or handle of some sort. This particular weapon was shoved in her mouth, as well as shoved up her rectum so far that it punctured her uterus.
We looked at the people that showed up to the Gamble store the day of the murder.
We reached out to Gary McGee, an EMT who was called to the location of the murder, to see if he would be comfortable speaking with us. We wanted to interview McGee so that he could set the scene of what everything was like that day. We wanted more information about how the basement was set up and how chaotic it was in the store after the murder occurred. We felt it was necessary to get a timeline of who showed up at the scene and the events that occurred in order after that.
When we pulled up out front, the police officer, Larry Finkbeiner was his name, he's dead, but he had the door open and was shooing customers out of the store.
This helped our image of how chaotic the store was back then. Nowadays, I have a feeling that there would be a more organized fashion of getting everyone to leave the crime scene safely. Throughout our time researching this case, we often realize how old this case is. Everything was done very differently during this time period. One of the reasons this case is so hard to solve is because there wasn't any technology or tools to preserve evidence efficiently back in the day. To try to get as much evidence as we possibly can from the interview, we asked McGee about the things he noticed when he got down to the basement.
I was being led to where Jeanette's body was. When you come down the steps at the store in the basement, into the pet store there, the checkout counter was on the right, and they led us to a doorway that was in the corner. And that's where she was. She was laying under, there were some elevated cages. I don't know if they had birds in them or what, but she was laying under the cages.
Although we had already proven some of this information he told us to be true, we were still appreciative to have heard what it was like that day from somebody that was actually there. Another person we spoke to was Lana, Jeanette's sister. Lana has shared her frustration about her sister's death.
Today we're here 42 years ago. 42 years ago. That's a long time. It shouldn't be 42 years. I was talking to somebody, I don't remember who. Can you remember 1983? Can you remember what this town was like in 1983? This town wasn't like this in 1983. A lot of things have changed since 1983. And then I was thinking about the 7 unsolved murders that are in this county. I was trying to see if there was a connection between any of them. Any tiny little connection. Because that's how I am, I pick things apart. And the only thing, maybe, is the one thing they all had in common, except maybe the real estate lady, was none of them were rich. None of them had money. They were at or below the poverty line. They were nobodies. As far as culture is concerned, they were just bodies. But if you look at the pictures, Jeanette had a family. Jeanette was a person. Jeanette had feelings. Jeanette had hopes. She had dreams. And whoever is still out there that took her life got to live their life. Hopes, dreams, vacations, everything. They got to do that. Jeanette didn't. She didn't get to see her kids grow up. She didn't get to see her grandkids or her even great-grandchild. She didn't get to see that. Whoever has done this took away a piece of a family. I'm not saying our family is perfect, far from it. But they took a piece of family. They took a human being.
Through Lana, we learned a lot about what kind of person Jeanette was. Sweet and kind. Similar to Jenny, Lana did not have a very good impression of the detectives on her sister's case.
Jeanette's case was limited in the amount of information anyone had about the case. It felt frustrating for her. She spoke to us about being angry that her sister's case has not yet been solved. Imagine the pain you would feel if you had a loved one who was murdered and their case was not yet solved after 42 years. The final person we spoke to, to get closer to solving this case, was Jim Clementi, a retired supervisory special agent from the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit. He encouraged us to shift our perspective to the killers.
So as a profiler, the crime tells a story. And we want to be able to read that story. We look for behavioral clues that indicate the kind of person who committed that crime. And understand that behavior reflects personality. So personality is incredibly important.
To achieve this, we concentrated exclusively on the crime scene to ascertain the mindset of the killer. This approach required us to examine the case as if we had no suspects, thereby expanding our understanding and perspective.
The way everything occurred has us asking a few questions. Can both a male and a female be able to drag Jeanette's body to the end of a room? Can a female have enough force to knock Jeanette out in the first place? We know Jeanette was a relatively small person in size. So to answer our questions, we performed a few experiments in our class. We used a student in our class who was close to the same height and weight as Jeanette, and tested if an average-sized female could drag the body across the floor of our classroom. Through this test, we determined that both a male and female possess enough strength to drag someone the same size as Jeanette across the room.
Through the autopsy, we determined that both a male and female could knock out Jeanette. We know one of the first wounds Jeanette suffered, one of those being a blow to the head with something heavy. Now that we know the possible type of person, we need to focus on what kind of personality would the murderer have? What motives could they possibly have? What is their mindset? What were they thinking while the murder was taking place?
Now that we know about the case in depth, we would have to find out what kind of person would do this. What was their mindset? We are using 5 questions to answer this. The first question to help us figure this out is, was the killer calculated? If we think back on our information, we can come up with the most likely conclusion, which is that the killer did not premeditate this murder, nor did they calculate it. The first reason was the crime was not well hidden. The killer left all the weapons in the room and left trails and puddles of blood everywhere. Through this, we can tell that they did not have the experience nor the rationale to have been a calculated murder. The second reason is when people are planning to murder someone, they usually bring the weapon they would commit the murder with. However, the murderer here used weapons they found located in the basement. This shows us the murderer most likely did this spontaneously.
The second question, was this premeditated? The question of whether a crime is premeditated or spontaneous is important to understand the motives and traits of the person who committed it. In this murder case that took place during the day in a busy store, several factors suggest it was not planned in advance. Generally, criminals prefer to commit acts where they have a lower chance of being caught, such as in secluded places or at night. However, this murder happening in a crowded store goes against this usual behavior. The timing of the murder is key. Committing a crime in a busy location during daylight raises the chances of being seen and caught. T Typically, criminals avoid situations with many witnesses. This act shows a reckless disregard for safety, supporting the idea that it was not premeditated.
Additionally, the perpetrator's actions can reveal more. If a crime was planned, one would expect careful preparation and strategic actions. If the person acted without regarding potential witnesses, it indicates impulsiveness rather than planning. Recent examples show that many public crimes occur without prior thought, often reflecting quick decisions made under stress. The evidence suggests that this murder was not premeditated. The crime's location and timing imply impulsive behavior rather than careful planning. Recognizing the difference between premeditated and spontaneous acts is crucial, providing insights into criminal behavior and motivations. This case highlights that not all crimes are calculated, and impulsive choices can lead to tragic results.
The third question, what were the feelings happening during the crime? We can make the conclusion the killer was clearly mad at Jeanette. The stomping on the chest and the abrasions everywhere are all tell signs they wanted to cause as much harm to her as they could. All of the weapons were all signs of aggression. If the amount of pain they caused Jeanette wasn't enough, the killer went as far as to humiliate her body. Cuts on the chest and the situation with the rod, the killer went out of their way to humiliate the parts of Jeanette that made her a woman. We believe the killer and Jeanette have met, whether it's personally or acquainted.
Based on our evidence so far, we believe that Jeanette must have known her killer. At the crime scene, a half-eaten sandwich was found on the cash register. We have confirmed that this was Jeanette's sandwich because her DNA was found on the sandwich. We also found out from the autopsy that there were traces of a sandwich in her stomach. The same ingredients that were found in her stomach were the same ingredients that were found on the sandwich that was sitting on the counter where the cash register was sitting. From this information, we can infer that Jeanette willingly left her lunch to go to the back room. Something or someone would have needed to distract Jeanette in order to make her stop eating and head to the back room where the bird cages were.
So, right here, this is the new information we got from the police file, this door. So, they found all the blood was back here, and there was blood spatter, they said, on the back of this door. That's when we were talking about the other day about, you know, when we were kind of profiling the scene and what could that mean? That means is that the door was closed when the assault happened. And we started talking about, like, what could that mean? What do we think it could mean if she was back here with someone else and this door was closed?
Definitely private talk.
Sounds kind of to me
middle,
that's
in the middle of the lunch, personal, like, had to be personal level.
Right. And had a conversation. Originally, we just thought, right, that maybe she just got ambushed back here or something happened. But the fact that this door was closed, I mean, it could mean a lot of things. It could mean she was back there and that the killer closed the door. But it also could be that everything happened right here. If they stepped back to have a private conversation and close, because we got to remember, these weren't open. This was all fish tanks. But they closed the door. So it started here and then it led into here. These were bird cages.
The belief that the individual in question must have known Jeanette stems from our investigation into the audibility of screams from the basement. During our visit to Reed City, we observed that normal conversations could be heard from the basement while standing upstairs, and the same was true in reverse. Consequently, if Jeanette had perceived a threat from her killer, it is reasonable to assume she would have screamed. However, no one in the store reported hearing any screams that day. The basement remained completely silent throughout. Additionally, the absence of blood near the counter suggests that she was likely taken to the back room.
This evidence suggests that Jeanette was neither struck by the counter nor dragged to the back room. Instead, she must have voluntarily accompanied her assailant, feeling secure enough to close the door behind her. The fact that the door was shut when she received the initial blow to the head rendering her unconscious, supports this theory. Bloodstains on the back of the door leading to the room with bird cages further indicate that it was closed at the time of the attack. This strongly suggests that she willingly shut the door to engage in conversation with her killer. Based on this analysis, we have identified a prime suspect, one that directly contradicts the conclusions of the previous investigation. We believe the perpetrator is a woman.
Underestimated. Jeanette Robertson was researched, written, and produced by Chelsea, Stephanie, Aubrey, Riley, Logan, and Carter. Intro music done by Haley. All other music done by Shane Yoder. Our show artwork was created by Chelsea, and our series artwork was also created by Chelsea. The Underestimated podcast is a production created in the Brandywine Community Schools Broadcasting CTE program. We want to thank you for listening, and a huge thank you to our community sponsors for supporting us and helping fund our work. Please make sure you leave us a review on your favorite podcast player. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Underestimated.